Yawa Radio.
Be happy. Be inspired.
A warm welcome to the Yawa Radio Podcast. The Yawa Radio Podcast is an opportunity again to listen to one of our inspirational, thought-provoking interviews that we have brought to the listeners of Yawa Radio. Yawa Radio is online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are your well-being and happiness radio station, bringing the feel-good feeling to every single day of the week. Check us out at yawaradio.co.uk. Now sit back and enjoy this podcast from the Yawa Radio team.
Welcome to Jordan Space. Every fortnight, you can join me, your host, Steve Phillip, alongside Danielle and Paul from the Jordan Legacy team, together with some very special guests for an hour of conversation, music, and above all, hope. Welcome to Jordan Space. This show does discuss themes of suicide, and we'd encourage you to take care of yourself by stepping away from the show at any point, should you find the content triggering or uncomfortable to listen to. For support, please visit our website, thejordanlegacy.com, and our help menu options. Welcome to show 35 of Jordan Space. I'm Steve Phillip, your host, and I'm joined by my regular co-hosts, Danny and Paul. Welcome to you both. Shortly, we'll be speaking with our guest, Ellie Hatto. Before then, today's initial chat with Danny, Paul, and myself is going to explore the extremely sensitive subject of voluntary assisted dying. A topic which Paul has developed a particular interest and understanding about. And Paul, when we published our report, Moving Towards a Zero Suicide Society, and asked for feedback, one question we got was how our zero suicide model related to assisted suicide or assisted dying. What's the distinction?
Yeah, we did get quite a few, didn't we? At the webinars, we got a couple of questions in the chat, and we got sent some messages about it, so we ended up putting something in the executive summary in the second edition about this to try and clarify. And the language is always important here, so even the distinction between assisted suicide, assisted dying, those of us who work in the area of assisted dying or voluntary assisted dying, we try and avoid the term assisted suicide because that has different meanings. So the key distinction for us is that we have our definition of a zero suicide society, which is a society that is willing and able to do all it can to prevent all preventable suicides. So this is people who don't want to die. This is people who might have episodic mental illness and short-term crises, but they don't want to die. And we're trying to do everything we can to keep those people alive. And their loved ones are doing everything they can, and their clinicians are doing everything they can, and all their community support. Voluntary assisted dying is where people want to die. And it is where, in particular, people have a terminal illness and they're in extreme pain, and they might say unbearable pain. And they want the option to end their lives. And they want the option to be able to do that with dignity and with their loved ones around them. And if they don't have that option, they sometimes will take their own lives when they don't want to, in horrible circumstances, without their loved ones around them, and somebody, maybe one of their loved ones, finding them in horrible circumstances. So yeah, it's an important distinction. This is, you know, people who assisted dying is people who want to die. What we're doing is about preventable suicides where people don't want to die.
I think that's a really important distinction, and thanks for sharing that, Paul, because I know we get comments on LinkedIn and on our social media posts about this, and I think that's been really helpful. I suppose another question that often comes up, certainly we've talked about it before, is what's the legal position in this country and in other countries around voluntary assisted dying?
Yeah, it is about the legal position. When suicide was decriminalised in 1961, it was no longer a criminal offence for someone to attempt suicide. They couldn't be imprisoned for attempting suicide. They could before 1961. But what wasn't decriminalized was assisting someone to take their own life. That is still a criminal offense. And for many years, everybody thought that was quite right, that was a criminal offense. These days, it's murky because you've got people who've got a loved one who is dying in terrible circumstances with a terminal illness. They want to end their lives. And, you know, they're not able to because the law doesn't enable that and the system isn't set up here in the UK. In other countries, it is. I mean, when I lived in Australia, We had voluntary assisted dying with the big breakthroughs in Victoria, and I actually sat in the Victorian Parliament an all-night sitting to get that legislation through. And I heard some of the worst things I've ever heard in a Parliament building during that so-called debate. But it was setting up a system where people could, in certain circumstances, in very controlled circumstances, could choose to end their lives. And that legislation then went round all of the states, and now it's across the whole of Australia. And there are other countries around the world now, about 26 different countries or jurisdictions, where New Zealand, at the last general election, had a referendum as well. So there was a conditional vote by MPs in favour, and then it went to a referendum, and the whole population voted in favour. So that clarified that one, and that's a good system in New Zealand. In this country, there was a vote in 2015, was the last vote in the UK Parliament, and MPs voted 3-1 against. But many MPs have said since then that they've changed their minds on this. They've seen better evidence. They've seen how it works in other countries, and they want to support it. And we now have a clear majority of the population in polls regularly saying they want voluntary assisted dying for people with a terminal illness.
What happens if someone has a loved one who wants to die, so maybe wants to go to Dignitas in Switzerland to die, and they ask them to help them?
Well, unfortunately, in that situation, they're in trouble. It would be illegal for them to assist the loved one in any way. And that includes if they choose to go to Dignitas. So if you've got a person with a terminal illness who chooses to go to Switzerland, who goes through all the relevant processes so they qualify, pays their money, sets everything up and has that there as an option, and they're of sound mind, and so there's absolutely no question about it being their choice. If their loved one is seen to be assisting them in any way, they are breaking the law in this country. And if their loved one travels with them to Switzerland, they will be arrested when they return. Or if it's made known that they're trying to travel, they will be arrested. They may be arrested at the airport as they're trying to travel to Switzerland with the person they want to be with at the end of their life. And as the law currently stands, somebody can be imprisoned for up to 15 years for assisted.
Staying with this theme, Paul, our guest today is Ellie Hatto, whose father took his own life at the age of 82. And we'll hear more about Ellie's experience later. But it's quite unusual to hear about suicides among older people, isn't it?
It is unusual to hear about it. It's not unusual for it to happen. Sadly, there are very high suicide rates amongst older people. And some years, when the ONS put their data out, men aged 80 plus have the highest suicide rate of any age, gender specific category. It's just that people don't often talk about it. They talk about middle-aged men. They talk about rising rates amongst young people. And there's the highest rates amongst older people, and nobody talks about it. It's something we need to talk about. A lot of research has been done. I've done a lot of research. I'm a trustee with Age UK, and I do a lot of work with older people. And there are some obvious suicide risk categories, like an older person, particularly an older man, losing a lifelong partner. I just had that with a neighbour, 86 years old, married for 56 years, lost his wife. He's immediately in a high suicide risk category. Or someone very active outdoors who loses their mobility and decides that there's nothing worth living for after that. So we really should. There's nothing in the National Suicide Prevention Strategy about older people. There's no mention there about older people. So we really should think about this.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, we're always going to be talking about this subject much more during the show. But for now, many thanks both. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we will be speaking with our guest, Ellie Hatto. Before then, let's listen to one of the tracks that Ellie has chosen, which is My Sharia More by Stevie Wonder.
Now, did you know more and more people are starting the day the Yawa Breakfast way? Now, why don't you join me for breakfast from 7 a.m. right through till 11 a.m. every day of the week on Yawa Radio. We are your truly well-being and happiness station. Why not start your day by bringing the feel-good feeling to every day? Join me for Yawa Breakfast from 7 a.m. every day of the week.
Welcome back. Our guest on this week's Jordan Space is Ellie Hatto. Ellie is the co-founder and CEO of Greenspark Renewables Limited, based in Bristol. However, at the Jordan Legacy, we know Ellie as the founder and CEO of Beside Yourself, CIC, a community interest company which encourages people to talk and write openly about a range of human behaviours and how they deal with what life throws at them. Ellie, welcome to the show. It's really good to have you join us today.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So, Ellie, you tragically lost your dad, Alan, to suicide in 2013 after he'd experienced a period of a couple of years of physical and mental health decline. Can you describe what that time was like for you and your family, and were there any signs that your dad was considering ending his own life?
Well, it was like most sudden deaths, you know, that like suicide, it was a massive shock. I'd never really known anyone who died or taken their own life in that way before. It was a major shock to everyone. I've got a sister and I just become a new mum. I only had a 4-month-old little boy at the time. So it was a massive invasion of our life, something we'd never thought would happen. Looking back now in the work I do, there probably were many signs. Again, hindsight is a wonderful thing. You don't always know where that will end up. And many of us don't think that it will end up in someone taking their own life. But he got to a point of 80 and he was a very physical, you know, he was a carpenter. He repaired cars. He did ballroom dancing. He was a golfer, a very sort of physical person. So when he hit 80, 2 years before he died, he started to decline physically and started not being able to do things. And he was being looked at for possible Parkinson's as well. So for him to lose that physicality was a major deal. So with the loss of that, his mental health started to decline and we noticed things that were out of character, you know, which sadly then ended in his taking his own life, which I witnessed the aftermath of that. So that made it one of those things imprinted now on my brain and probably something I will never forget. So yeah, a massively life-changing thing that plays on your mind all the time, hence why I'm involved in this work now.
I can imagine. And I relate very much to what you're saying about your father reaching the age of 80 and not being able to do maybe some of the things physically. My own mother and Daniel's grandmother, of course, her Nana, very much the same. I have been a very active, a very young older lady until reaching her mid-80s now and frustrated more than anything with not being able to do the things that she could do once upon a time.
And much more common as well than people may realise. It's that hope, isn't it? If there's nothing else to think about, it's okay when you're younger and you're not in that position. But I think many of us, and probably myself, I'm thinking that probably be a thought thing that will go through my mind. So we need to think more about that.
Obviously, I was sorry to hear about your dad, Ellie, and I've worked in suicide prevention since 2013, the year that your dad died. So I've learned a lot about it. I'm also a trustee with Age UK, and I sit on the Age UK National Influencing and Campaigning Committee. And we do know that, you know, people who lose that physicality, that mobility, and people who lose a partner as well, a lifelong partner, are at high suicide risk. But when we actually work in suicide prevention, as we do, we hear so much about young people. Children, young people. It's the biggest killer of men and women under 35. And we hear about middle-aged men and high suicide rates. We hear about it being the biggest killer of men, age under 50. We don't hear much about older people. We don't hear much at all about suicide amongst older people. Why do you think that is?
I think because it's something that, you know, again, statistics will lead that, won't they, with younger people and men and that kind of thing. But I think It's incorrect that we don't talk more about that, because I think it does affect many older people. Reasons why, I'm not sure whether it's that natural course of things, maybe, that people assume that, you know, you get older and you're okay with that path to decline and sadly death. Maybe that's part of it. I don't really know exactly why that is, but it certainly does affect many older people, you know, and continues to, and as I said, talk about that much more.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually the statistics actually show that some of the highest suicide rates are amongst men aged 80 plus. Small numbers, but the highest rates.
Mm.
So it is baffling in that sense. But I mean, we've heard some horrible comments during the COVID inquiry about older people being expendable and horrible comments. I mean, is there really a societal problem here, do you think?
Absolutely. Because again, that thing that older people are maybe a drain on resources, perhaps, you know, the NHS, and that younger people should be concentrated on. But I do think that, you know, it is the work I do and working in suicide prevention, which is led by my own bereavement. There are massive connections between prevention. You know, in my dad's case, it would have been great had he have not taken that step for himself, for his own mental health, even though he knew that he wasn't going to get any better. And for the family around him, who've been left now with the absolute devastation, even 10 years on, it's still a very shocking thing that I sometimes don't even believe it still happened, because it's so traumatic and devastating. I think that the whole suicide element and suicide prevention, there should be ways that people like my dad could have had a different way out. I don't think for one moment that he had an alternative to declining, and that was his decision. Had he have had a different way out, and we always used to joke, he was quite a funny sort of character that, you know, we say about going to Switzerland, you know, one-way ticket to Switzerland, but I would say he'd have been too tight to do that. I mean, I'm joking aside, he wouldn't have done that. It wouldn't have been his idea to sit and have a lovely meal with all his darling family around him the night before. That just wasn't his style. Not everything suits everyone. It's not all that romanticized view. But I would have liked him not to have to have gone through the whole planning and the execution of what he did for him and everyone around him. There has to be a better way.
You talked about him joking about going to Switzerland, but maybe there was something more underlying there that he might have been insinuating that you weren't aware of. Did he ever mention anything to you or insinuate in other ways that you might have been thinking about Switzerland?
Well, interestingly, you say that. Yes, he did. I mean, decades ago, interestingly, that when he was in his sort of 50s or so. I mean, my mum died and his wife died when I was four. So he was, dare I say, left with me and my sister, who's 2 years older than me. That was in 1980. She had bowel cancer and she was terminally ill, and she had a year to live, basically, and then sort of ebbed away and died. So he went through a major trauma, wasn't expecting that his life, and he had us sort of quite late. And he used to joke about things like, oh, Ellie, if things get really too bad later on, I'll just take the pills. And that was just his sort of thing. And I think that's quite common. But I think it was a throwback because he'd been through a very traumatic thing himself. And he was thinking, if anything really bad happens again, I need a way out. So we used to joke about it. But now looking back, of course, many of us don't know that sadly, the fine line between still being here and taking their own life and being on sadly the other side, wherever that might be or not. And all the people I talk to now who've been bereaved, the things that they've mentioned, the red flags and everything. And it's just so, that's the frustrating, devastating thing, isn't it, about suicide loss, that sadly many of us are on the other side of it and lost someone. But I'm very hyper focused and hyper vigilant about others now and things they say, or even strangers. And I think that's a kind of a blessing of being bereaved, but also a curse, because you think, wow, if only I'd have known all this before my loved one had taken their own life.
We've said exactly the same, haven't we, about Jordan in the days leading up to his death. You know, we talked about feeling trapped, and he used words that we now come across a lot, that we didn't know at the time were signs to look out for.
Ellie, for the opening segment of our show, we asked Paul about voluntary assisted dying and the important distinction between assisted dying as an informed choice for some people, i.e. those with a terminal illness, and what we would consider a preventable suicide in the case of someone who doesn't really want to die. So two questions here, I suppose, for you. How does this relate to your dad, do you feel? And what are your thoughts on voluntary assisted dying?
Well, I think it relates in terms of people who are terminally ill, diagnosed terminally ill. I understand that that is something that would relate to them. Again, in my dad's case, he wasn't diagnosed. He probably was on the lines of along the line being diagnosed, perhaps for Parkinson's, but that wasn't where he was at. So I think there is a fine line between people who are diagnosed with a condition, but my dad would have slipped through that net, you see, because he wasn't diagnosed, but he still knew, he you know, it's that thing, isn't it, taking away the pain thing, that not necessarily wanting to die, but not kind of almost not wanting to be here. And he knew that his natural and healthy life, it was the end. And that's everyone's right, I think, to say, actually, I'm out of here, but in a reasonable and you know, caring way. And that's why we are all here and doing the work we do.
Yeah, and it is a subject that's very complex, like suicide. It's very complex. It's multifaceted. So it does need a deep conversation and a long deliberation before the law is changed. So, for instance, we now know the vast majority of the public are in favour of assisted dying for people with a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live who are in unbearable pain and who have mental capacity. But that probably wouldn't include Parkinson's, and it probably wouldn't include that.
Again, it's linked to things like, and whether he's in a minority here, I don't know, but I suspect not. The thought of him going into, say, a care home or something like that, he couldn't think of anything worse. And I don't think that at the end of my life, I take that with relish. So I think that if people, they're not necessarily terribly ill, but they don't want their life to end up in that way. They don't want to cling on to life for the sake of clinging on to life. And I get that that's difficult in the suicide prevention world. You know, sadly, Steve and Danielle, you've lost your son and brother, but they are interlinked. The whole thinking around these things, they do differ with different age groups. I get that. But it's not just about the illness, I don't think.
since the last vote in Parliament, we've had fundamental shifts, like British Medical Association, which when we had the previous vote in 2015, they were against voluntary assisted dying. They've now shifted their position to be neutral and to leave it to individual doctors to make their own minds up. But there's a culture in the medical profession, ingrained, deeply ingrained, that you must do everything possible to keep people alive. So yeah. Even at the point at which people are saying, I want to die, they just cannot stop themselves. Every fibre of their body says, you must try and keep people alive. Yeah. But based on your experience with your dad, what would you say to a doctor who took that position?
There was something on the radio the other day, similar to what you've just said, Paul, about doctors. You know, they're trained to save people, not to end people's lives. And I completely get that. But it, looking at it in a human sense and my personal experience, they need to be aware that it's not just about that. Look at it from the bigger picture, because I have a friend at the moment who has an elderly parent in a care home, and they're being called in for a meeting this week about the parent is all they were talking about. They've got some dementia, but going in and out of kind of lucidity and that kind of thing. But all they're talking about is getting pills to end their life. And you've got to listen to this stuff. How many people in care homes may express these views? How do we know? We don't know, do we? But until we know these things and contrast it with doctors' views and everything else. But just to say point blank, we have to preserve life at any cost. Is wrong. And I know there's certain things within the medical environment whereby things can be hastened, if you like, due to medications and that kind of thing. But people at home, like my dad, that he would avoid the doctors. He would have lied on the risk assessment, you know, suicide risk. Even the doctor was deeply shocked and moved and you know, upset by what had happened, which surprised me. I thought a doctor would be, another one, you know, but that tells you that this stuff is important, but the different groups need to come together to talk about and talk about people who are going through it like me and like the rest of us.
Just a final question for me, Ellie. Within the debates, which relates back to suicide as well, preventable suicides as we would call them, there's issues around quality of life. And in the areas of people with terminal illness, it's often unbearable pain. They use the term unbearable pain. So somebody is given the right to end their lives at that point. We know a lot of people who take their own lives, younger people as well, are in unbearable pain. They would describe it as unbearable pain. And in terms of quality of life, you've got older people saying there's nothing else to live for. And we kind of accept that in a way we don't with younger people, right?
Yeah.
So with a younger person, if they say their quality of life is such that they want to end their lives, we tend to say we must do something about that.
So it is a fascinating thing. And again, I would say that there are certain situations whereby even younger people, I've had people that I support many people who've been bereaved. And interestingly, they've said that some of their younger family members, sons and daughters, have just not been cut out for this world. Several people have said that. And whatever happens and whatever medication they have or therapy or whatever change of environment, that sadly was an inevitable outcome. And several people have said that to me, and it's not just about older people, you know, getting to the end. But I do understand that it's a fine line between the experience I've had and losing a younger person, because they have, you know, in all intents and purposes, a life ahead of them to live for. And we should prevent suicide at all costs, really, and at least reduce it. It may not be completely preventable, but we have to look at the whole bigger picture, don't we, of changing things.
It's clearly a challenging subject, isn't it? And not an easy subject to answer at all, but I think a really important discussion, Ellie. Thank you so much for sharing your story so far. We're going to take a break, have a breather. We've been playing a number of tracks that you've chosen for us today. The next one we're going to play is Sing by the Carpenters. Why is this song particularly important to you?
Well, this is one that I actually sang this when I was in a choir about 10 years ago as a solo, which was very scary. But it's a song I've always loved, actually, from being a child. And I know that when my mum died, she had a big stack of, you know, 70s records and everything. And Carpenters was one of her favourites and one of my favourites as well. So I really like this one.
There's a real connection with your mum for this particular song there.
Yeah.
Oh, well, excellent. Well, look, thank you, Ellie. Let's take a break now. We're going to listen to Sing by the Carpenters, and we'll be right back with Ellie after this.
Hi, it's Zoe Bishop here. If you want to get your weekend off to the best start, join me every week for my Feel Good Friday show from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. 2 hours of fab music, wellbeing tips, and Friday fun.
This is Yawa Radio.
Welcome back. Before the break, we've been talking with our guest, Ellie Hatto, who lost her dad, Alan, to suicide when he was 82. We've also been exploring the topic of voluntary assisted dying as an informed choice for some people, and what we would consider a preventable suicide in the case of someone who doesn't really want to die. Ellie, how does what you experienced with your dad influence the work you do now, what you say in your talks, and what you may say privately to someone with an older relative who doesn't want to live anymore?
Well, when my dad died, I was that evening, I was ferociously, like many of us, Googling suicide because it was something that had never entered my life before. And I came across a charity called Survivors of Bereavement by Suicide, or SOBS. And a few months later, they set up a group in my area down in Hampshire where I live. And I started going along. It was peer support. I'd never heard of peer support, really. I had an inkling of what it was, but didn't really know. And people said, oh, Ellie, you better get some therapy, the classic stuff. And I started going along to that group. That was, well, it was a couple of years, actually, after it happened. But so I've been going since for about 7 or 8 years. And I just went 1 month. I cried all the way there. I don't know why I cried, but I just, something emotionally, you know, got me. And I've never stopped going since. You know, there's so many similarities with suicide bereavement, but everyone's experience is different. But there are so many similarities. You don't get the raised eyebrows, the sort of look of, oh, no, she's mentioned suicide. Let's step across the road and ignore her. So that's something that I guess is a platform, really, for me to talk about suicide and talk about it openly in a safe space, really.
What do you think it is about suicide bereavement, Ellie, that makes it more difficult maybe than other types of bereavement, perhaps in your own personal experience? Or,
well, I think it's different because you invariably don't get a warning. It's very sudden. That there's massive elements of guilt around it because you think, as I said earlier, that you know, the flags and things that you may realise now, you think, oh, if only I'd have known that, I could have done something and stepped in. So I think, you know, the stigma around suicide, you know, it's a big deal.
Ellie, it was lovely to hear you talking about SOBS and the support you've got there and being able to speak so freely there about suicide, because obviously people do know. But obviously in your work, you have got other people who are not aware of these things or are not as comfortable talking about it, and also around the assisted dying stuff as well. If you have an older person or a relative, an older person talking about ending their life based on the experience that you've now got, you know, I just wonder how that would impact on what you might say. And this might be somebody you come across in your work that's a stranger who just says, I've got, my father is thinking of.
Yeah, and I have been asked that question quite a few times, and it's a difficult one to answer, I find, because there aren't really, as what we said earlier, there's nothing really in place to actively support someone going through that. People have said, you know, my dad didn't get to the stage where I thought, I wonder what I would have said if he'd have said to me, Ellie, would you help me out? And I think, how would I have felt in that situation? Because I'm on the other side, I have a different perspective, I guess, to had he have not done that. And again, it wouldn't have been something I would have contemplated, I guess. So it had no real choice on that. And he had to do what he had to do.
And you, in that situation, we know lots of people, sadly, in that situation where their older relatives or a person with a disability wanting in their life has asked their partner or relative to help them. It's illegal.
And
carry a prison sentence. But sometimes the passionate desire to care for that person leads them into difficult territory.
Absolutely, because I do think about it a lot. And as you say, the deep caring for someone, it's kind of outweighs the, would I have preferred to have done that, even though it's illegal, than him doing what he did and having to take that into his own hands? And for me, helping him, it would have been an easier, if you like, process. But obviously a very challenging one, because I think many people in that situation, and I'm thinking about myself, that they would want to help out. They would want to do that, but they know that's not the right way to go because it's illegal and it's a horrible thing that they have to then live with and carry. But if there were things in place that would alleviate that, but still give that person the right to end their life in the right circumstances, then again, we should be looking at that more.
Ellie, some months ago, you provided the Jordan Legacy with a short video to help support our petition to Parliament, which was requesting the introduction of a Suicide Prevention Act. In that video, you say that if suicide prevention was more advanced, then maybe your dad might have taken a different route and had other options open to him. What are some of the things you believe need to change as far as preventing suicides is concerned?
Well, I think in terms of suicide prevention, it's looking at it in a sort of overall view in terms of all ages, all life stages. I think that the work, it has to be informed by people with lived experience, and indeed is, and that's why we're sitting here today, which is really positive. And I always say as well that it's not always just about the final act of suicide. It's about educating children and taking away the stigma, because suicide thoughts are real, and I've had them. I expect many of you, if not all of you, have had them. And we shouldn't make it the elephant in the room, because it doesn't always mean that we'll go on to die by suicide. But it's a natural thing to think when you are struggling and in a difficult position or situation. But the more we talk about it, the better.
Eddie, you said that your dad was a carpenter. And I understand you're working in the construction sector.
I do, yes.
And we know that the construction sector has a very high suicide rate, and people are 10 times more likely to die by suicide than physical accidents at work. What are your insights into how we can get suicide numbers down in the construction sector?
Well, again, it's talking about it more. You've said about the statistics, that they are real, aren't they? There are charities out there doing good work in this area, but you know, I guess it's things like the kind of the nature, isn't it, I guess, of construction, that sometimes it can be quite sort of peaks and troughs. It's massively affected by financial crises and that kind of thing. And again, it's very male dominated industry. It's a tricky one. You know, working in construction, I understand there are challenges with that. The HSE are much more interested in and need to push the whole mental health first aid side of things, suicide first aid, all those other things that can help. And things aren't going to change necessarily in everyone's lives that are suddenly going to become miraculously different and perfect. But I think it's mechanisms to manage that within that industry.
Ellie, I want to talk a little bit about some of the work you're doing now with Beside Yourself, and particular focus on life after suicide and supporting those who've been directly impacted by such a loss. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yeah, so as I said, I mentioned that I'm Beside Yourself. So I set that up in late 2022. I just wanted, after many years, I became a facilitator with SOLVES, and I was on the board of trustees. So really involved in that way. And all the people I meet, I just feel so, hopefully I support them, but also it's a massive healing element for me, because as I said, I would never talk about my dad, and I do like talking, and I just want to be in a situation whereby I can chat to people about anything and everything, and no holds barred, warts and all, because that is, as we know, the journey of suicide bereavement. So I, Beside Yourself is more of a thing about almost a reflection of my personality and doing things and talking about suicide. I do write blogs, I do vlogs and that kind of thing. And we're just building it, looking at podcasts as well. Last year, I took part in a charity program by Sound Delivery Media, and it was a media spokesperson program. Again, so that equipped me, it gave me lots of confidence, actually, and equipped me with skills within the media. Because there is, as we know, not just about the assisted dying element, there are elements of social injustice around suicide bereavement and prevention. So again, it's about really that there's things, you know, I hear loads of people, I mean, in my SOBS group that I help facilitate, that we get loads of issues with services designed to support them are not always up to snuff, shall we say. So things like police inquests, that kind of thing. So I wrote a blog recently about the treatment in inquests from people's perspective of suicide bereavement, because as you said, Danielle, there's the enhanced sort of experience that suicide bereavement relates to needs looking at, and let's say special treatment, but there are certain things that need to be looked at that add to the pain of someone going through bereavement. So yeah, so I do all of those things. I'm also part of a Voices People with Living Experience of Suicide collective, we call ourselves, with Hampshire County Council. We have it's a lived experience group of people who get involved with the design and delivery and evaluation, actually, of public health related initiatives and projects. And we sit on forums within the cities of Hampshire. So we're highly welcomed in there. So it's all about, really, for me, talking about normalizing talking about suicide. I feel very comfortable about talking about it. I know not everyone does, but that's, I guess, because we've been touched by it in some way. So with Beside Yourself, yeah, just carrying on, seeing where it goes.
And really providing a voice in lots of different ways,
yeah,
around
absolutely.
Different topics. And is Beside Yourself kind of accessible across the country, or is it Hampshire? Is it a particular
area?
Yeah,
no, it's an online, it's on website. So all the content is free for, you know, for Hampshire, the UK, the world to look at.
We'll make sure we include that all in the show notes and put on the website. Ellie, thanks so much for everything you've shared with us today. It's been a fascinating fascinating conversation, which I'm sure our listeners are really going to get huge value from. We always like to end our conversation by asking our guests to share a message of hope. And I'm just wondering who your message is going to be for and what that message would be.
I think my message really is for almost everyone that, as I touched on earlier, that mental health and taking care of yourself and well-being doesn't always, you know, if that isn't going well, it doesn't always culminate in suicide. And we need to look at, let's think that people can experience suicidal thoughts and feelings, and that is okay. And it's not to panic about that. You know, I've done many suicide interventions as well of, you know, it's okay to not feel that great, and for us to think, have those thoughts. So I think it's just general hope that things hopefully will pass, and there are services out there to help.
Great. A really important message. One we hear quite often, but coming from someone like yourself with your own experience, I think it's really, really important. Before we let you go, Ellie, again, another track that you've chosen from us, and quite a change from the Carpenters that we talked about a little bit earlier. This one is titled Pleasure and the Pain from The Damned. So tell us a little bit about why this song's important.
Well, this is slightly eclectic, I should say, music taste. But yeah, this is something that I was listening to when I was about 15. So it kind of shaped my teenhood, if you like. And I just really love The Damned, their punk background, and Pleasure and the Pain. I just like this because it resonates with me in terms of the work I do and the bereavement I've experienced, because life is pleasurable and it's very painful, but we get through it as best we can.
And all summed up in this song, probably, Ellie.
Absolutely,
thank you.
Hopefully.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let's listen to Pleasure and the Pain by The Damned. And we'll be back in a few moments with Danny and Paul for a roundup of today's conversation with Ellie.
Bringing the feel-good feeling to every single day of the week. This is Yawa Radio. Now, did you know that you can download the Yawa Radio app for Android? Just go to the normal place where you download your apps. Just search for Yawa Radio and you can put Yawa Radio on your phone and you can take us with us in your pockets. And also, if you've got an Alexa, you can ask Alexa to play Opal Radio. Now, you may be wondering why. Well, Alexa is not that intelligent and it doesn't understand the word Yawa. So just ask it to play Opal Radio. So there you go. Two new ways you can listen to Yawa Radio. Download the Yawa Radio app for Android, or just ask Alexa to play Opal Radio. We are Yawa Radio, your truly well-being and happiness radio station, bringing the feel-good feeling to every single day.
Yawa Radio.
Be happy. Be inspired.
Well, Danny and Paul, what an interesting conversation with Ellie. We're touching on suicide, we're touching on voluntary assisted dying, and so many similarities in many ways. Danny, what were some of the key things you took away from our conversation with Ellie?
Yeah, I think like many of our Jordan Space guests, Ellie's been through a hugely traumatic experience, losing a loved one, a dad to suicide. And now she's sort of using this to do fantastic work in supporting others going through similar experiences in suicide bereavement, suicide prevention, and also as a voice for voluntary assisted dying. It's a topic that could be talked about for hours. You know, we mentioned that the work we do in suicide prevention is all about ensuring people don't take their own lives, whereas voluntary assisted dying is about supporting someone to take their own life. But I think what's important to recognise is that there are differences, as we discussed in listening to Ellie's experience, and it's not just a black and white subject.
No, that's really important. And like all the topics we talk about, it's really quite complex. And Paul, what about yourself? What were some of the key things for you?
I mean, it's a pleasure listening to Ellie because she's fun to listen to and she's fun to spend time with. So that's good. We need a bit of fun in the world of suicide prevention. But obviously behind that and behind all of these stories, as we call them, serious stuff, her dad, 82, and people think it's not the same because he was 82. I mean, what's that got to do with anything? As Chooks used to say to us, there's no hierarchy in suffering. And, you know, there should be no hierarchies in suicide prevention either, but there are, sadly, there are lots of hierarchies and status and ego and all these things. We have a competition that we have to wrestle with. What Ellie's done there is highlight an 82-year-old man who's decided there's no point going on with his life, or on balance, it's time to end his life. And we know the statistics show that there are very high suicide rates amongst older people, especially men aged 80 plus. But it rarely gets a mention. Some years in the UNS statistics, it's the single highest suicide rate of all the age gender groups. But doesn't appear anywhere in the national strategy, in the national suicide prevention. There's no mention of all the people in there. And like I mentioned, you know, the COVID inquiry, you know, people, so there's people out there, including former prime ministers, who think that older people are of a lesser value than younger people, which I think is quite disgusting. You know, so Ellie's given us some insights into her dad's situation and the fact that he laughed about it in some respects, joked about the whole thing, you know. So it's both sad and funny at the same time. And I think Ellie's a great communicator and I always enjoy working with her, and it's great to have her on the show.
Well, look, that's it for another episode of Jordan Space. My thanks to Danny and Paul and to this week's guest, Ellie Hatto. Thank you for tuning in. I hope today's episode has really given you some pause thought about a subject that hasn't been discussed a lot in the past, and hope, as with all our shows, you found it insightful. And if you felt inspired to support our work to help prevent suicides, you can, of course, make a donation on our website, thejordanlegacy.com, or get in touch via emailing hello@thejordanlegacy.com. Of course, you can engage with us on our social media platforms by following the Jordan Legacy's CIC's LinkedIn company page. We're also on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Instagram, and you can find us by using the username @JordanLegacyUK. Of course, we're also on Facebook under the Jordan Legacy CIC. You can listen to recordings of this show and of previous shows on our website by choosing the menu Jordan Space at the top of the homepage. But now, from Danny, Paul and myself, we'd like to wish you a safe, healthy and above all, hopeful rest of your week. And we're going to leave you with one final track chosen by Ellie, Nothing Else Matters by Metallica.
Yawa Radio.
Be happy. Be inspired.
A big thank you for taking the time out to listen to this podcast from the team at Yawa Radio. Remember to check us out live online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at yawaradio.co.uk. And if you'd like to join us as a guest on Yawa Radio or as a guest on the Yawa Radio podcast, we would love to hear from you. Simply email studio@yawaradio.co.uk. Once again, a big thank you for taking the time out to listen. This is the Yawa Radio podcast. Copyright applies.